This morning, we're going to continue on with the theme of just media in our culture, and I want to talk about regaining focus in an age of digital distractions. I know that I talked a little bit yesterday about some of those distractions, but we're going to get into more detail. And I'd like us to learn a lesson from the Titanic. On the Titanic's maiden voyage in 1912, she had some of the latest and greatest communications technology, which was the wireless telegraph. And this new technology not only provided critical communication between the ships, it provided this new amenity for the passengers to be able to pay to send messages back to their families and friends. So, but imagine being on a cruise ship today with only one cell phone to share between all the passengers if you wanted to send a text message. That's essentially what this telegraph was. And not only would you have to wait your turn, but the message had to be typed out with only one key. So it was because of that, in the 4.5 days until the Titanic struck the iceberg, the Titanic's radio operators had sent and received 250 passenger telegrams. But on the night of the disaster, Jack Phillips, the senior officer, was feverishly trying to keep up with passenger communications when a message came in from another ship, the SS Mesaba, warning of icebergs spotted at very specific coordinates. The Mesaba waited for confirmation from the Titanic's communications officer, and they didn't get a reply from Jack. Instead, he continued to send passenger messages. Now, the second officer, Charles Lightoller, had been on duty that night and wrote the following in his autobiography. This is an excerpt from his book called Titanic and Other Ships, published in 1935. He says, "The one vital report that came through, but which never reached the bridge, was received at 9:40 p.m. from the Mesaba, stating ice report in latitude 42 north, 41 to 25 north, longitude 49, and then we'll skip those details, saw much heavy ice pack, a great number of large icebergs, also field ice, weather good, clear. Phillips, the wireless operator on watch who received the message, was not to know the extreme urgency of the warning or that we were at the time actually entering the area given by the Mesaba and are literally packed with icebergs, field ice, and growlers. He was very busy working wireless messages to and from Cape Race, also with his accounts. The junior officer, Bride, of course, knew nothing about this vital warning, being off duty and turned in. Later, when standing with others on the upturned boat, Phillips explained when I said that I did not recollect any Mesaba report. This is what he said. I just put the message under a paperweight at my elbow just until I squared up what I was doing before sending it to the bridge." And so he goes on to say that delay proved fatal. So he's sending these messages, these passenger messages, and he's neglecting the most important message that should have made it to the bridge and never did. So it's a sober illustration of the potential distractions that come along with the benefits of technology. And there are tremendous benefits. There's no question that these new technologies, we're using them today. Your church is using them to live stream. I'm using them to give this presentation. We're using sound systems. There's so many things that we can do. But in the words of Neil Postman from his book Technopoly, he said, "It is a mistake to suppose that any technological innovation has a one-sided effect. Every technology is both a burden and a blessing. Not either or, but this and that." Now, I don't have this quote up on the screen, but let me just read it to you, because he goes on to say, "We are currently surrounded by throngs of one-eyed prophets who see only what new technologies can do and incapable of imagining what they will undo. We might call such people technophiles. They gaze on technology as a love does on his beloved, seeing it as without blemish and entertaining no apprehension for the future. The technophiles must speak for themselves and do so all over the place. My defense is that the dissenting voice is sometimes needed to moderate the din made by the enthusiastic multitudes. If you know anything about Neil Postman, he was the author of Amusing Ourselves to Death that was published in 1984. And the book Technopoly, I'm not sure what the publication date was, but it was in the 80s. And so you can imagine this is what he was saying in the 80s. Had no idea what was coming down the pike as far as the technological innovations that we are faced with today. And so the purpose of my talk this morning is not anti-media, it's not anti-technology, but it's a desire to help our generation, both adults and youth, to gain back important ground that is being lost in the digital age. We need to be able to know how to wisely handle technology, to use it for God's glory, to benefit the kingdom of God. But we also understand, as Neil Postman was saying, technology is not it's an either or. It's a this and that. It has tremendous blessings. It has tremendous burdens. And we're not handling it very well. And when we don't handle it well, then the blessings become undermined by the burdens that we are not handling. So it's why in 1 Peter 1:13 it says, "Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ." Another translation says, "Gird up the loins of your mind." So we need to prepare our minds for action. And as Christians, part of that now, even though Peter never imagined the things we were facing, but the Holy Spirit did when he spoke these words, and they still continue to speak to us today in our unique situation that we're facing. And so I'm encouraging us to as the title of this talk says, we need to regain focus in this age of digital distractions. We need to gain back what is being lost. And that's my hope, to convince you and also to give you some helpful tools today. We're going to really get into some nuts and bolts. And so this is about staying focused on what is critical, what is essential, what is eternal. And there have been challenges to Christians over the centuries. Obviously, when the Apostle Peter wrote this, it's because he believed that even Christians during his day needed to be encouraged to prepare their minds for action. That meant that they were already struggling with other issues. So much more today do we need to prepare our minds for action, because we have lost focus on what is required to cultivate. Primarily, one of the things I'm concerned about is our relationship with God, as well as our relationship with others. They're both important. When we look at the two greatest commandments that Jesus gave, he said, the number one commandment, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. And it's those two things that we're losing focus on in this age of digital distractions. And so when the Bible refers to seeking God, it's often given in this context of searching for him, seeking, praying to him, searching with him for all of our heart, with all of our heart, not half-hearted seeking God. What he is looking for is a full focus. And that's the great paradox right now in the digital age, that the paradox is that the digital age and these great technologies have provided us 24/7 digital connection to people around the world. But we have become more disconnected from the people closest to us. And we've become more disconnected from God, I believe. We've adopted a new culture of distraction, a culture of shallow and superficial social media relationships. And the use of technology is often undermining face-to-face relationships. And we have information overload. We're carrying a burden. Our younger generation is carrying a very heavy burden with all this technology. Sometimes, and by the way, especially for adults, there is a great need for radical compassion for the young people today. And because there's often a frustration at how they're using technology. I get it. I understand how you can be frustrated with it. But they're also a product of their environment, and it has a lot to do with how we are or are not helping them navigate these unique issues that we're facing today. And many times they're not seeing it modeled at home. So there needs to be a tremendous amount of compassion. And we're going to talk about the need to mentor this generation. But there are a ton of consequences. Let me just rattle off some of these. And I do it. I read a lot of books. I watch a lot of documentaries. I try to stay in tune with a lot of the information that's coming out that's being recognized about the technological age, how it's affecting people. Things like I was just reading about text neck. You know, so chiropractors are dealing with teens, and they've actually called it text neck. It's because of this all day long. Slouched in a chair, looking down. So physically, it's affecting. So now you got teens going into chiropractors because they have all sorts of things wrong with alignment just because they're constantly hunched over. We talked about loss of sleep yesterday. That has a lot to do with the blue light affecting circadian rhythms. There's radiation coming from phones that a lot of people, unfortunately, are not as concerned about as they ought to be. There's changes now that they're able to do mapping, brain mapping with the new technologies, and they're seeing changes in neurophysiology, meaning that the way we interact with technology actually does change how the brain is wired. It actually affects gray matter as well as white matter. There's been interference with good diet. We all know what that's like if you're sitting on the couch all the time watching TV, you tend to want a snack. That's for adults and kids as well. It interferes with exercise. A lot of young people are neglecting fresh air, sunshine, outdoor activity. In fact, years ago, I've been doing this ministry since 2003, traveling the country and speaking on this subject. And I remember we heard from one young person, I think he was around 12 years old, and he actually wrote to us and said, "I don't like the outdoors because there are no outlets." I'm like, wow. So we have a more sedentary lifestyle that's changing the body mass index. These are things, the adrenal system is being distorted as well as the endorphin system, the dopamine systems that God has given to us. There are a lot of interesting studies about this. Unfortunately, many of those are from an evolutionary worldview, but I think as Christians with a biblical worldview, we can look at those studies and analyze them from a biblical perspective, from a creation perspective. But no doubt there are things happening in the brain that are affecting this generation and affecting adults. We texting and driving is also one of those things that just continue to be a problem. There's tech addiction now and habituation. In South Korea, they have real big tech problems in South Korea. They actually have state-sponsored detox camps for kids with video game and internet addictions. Those are starting to pop up now here in the U.S. So there's, for children, there's, because of all the technology that we're allowing in their lives at a young age, there's a loss of imaginative play in children because the screen provides all of the images for them instead of them having to use their imagination. One of the things they're finding out too is just a lack of impulse control in children. So impulsivity is another effect of all this screen time. It stunts their creativity. Also, I'm a big fan. I believe God is a big fan of reading good books. Of course, the most important good book, God's book. And so that is, there's less reading now, and there's a ton of misdiagnosis that even doctors are seeing of ADD, ADHD, bipolar. Dr. Victoria Dunkley is one of those who I watched her give a seminar recently. She's working with kids that are oftentimes diagnosed with these things. She has a whole protocol. She takes them off screens for 4 weeks, and guess what? A lot of these symptoms disappear. They're not there. They've been misdiagnosed. Instead, many other doctors are putting them on meds. So there's a ton of things happening. So the Christian response to these sweeping changes covers a broad spectrum. Now, the first one is at one end of the extreme is aversion and disallowance. That's almost non-existent anymore, honestly. You know, maybe if we went back 20 years ago, especially in the homeschool community, maybe there was a little more aversion and disallowance of technology. But I don't see it hardly anymore. It's very rare. I was speaking with Pastor Carey last night about an interesting time. I got invited to speak at a church in upstate New York that's all former Amish Hutterites and Old Order Mennonites. And if you thought that if anybody wouldn't have a problem, it would be Amish Hutterites and Mennonites, Old Order Mennonites, and yet their kids are having such a problem with technology. They're like, we need someone to come in and speak to our group. So that was very interesting, for sure. So now I'm not convinced that this even is very applicable, but I put it in there for you. All right, the opposite extreme to this is what I would call heedless enthusiasm. I'm always nervous when I talk to people who are just heedlessly enthusiastic about technology. I am not a technophile, neither am I a technophobe. I land right in the middle. I use technology. I think it's got some powerful tools, but at the same time, I'm not gaga over it. I know that there are some concerns. So the space in between, this is probably where most Christians land. It between those two extreme poles are Christians who are complacent. They just get swept up in the stream of culture, not thoughtful about it, not proactive about it, and eventually what happens is they see the results and they don't like it, and that's usually when they call me too late. They're saying, I don't like what I gave my 12-year-old a smartphone and I don't like the fruit of it. Well, can you fix the problem? I'm like, I don't know if I can fix this problem. I can give you some guidance, but this is challenging. So there's some better options that we're going to be talking about. Better options, and that is deliberate discernment. Deliberate. We're not going to just passively, we're not going to be complacent about this. We're going to be deliberate about discernment. There's going to be reasonable convictions. Biblical and reasonable convictions. There's going to be careful, there's careful handling. So you can learn to handle it. Let me just share for a moment. I'll talk about how powerful these tools are, but the more powerful a tool is, I'm a woodworker. It's a hobby, and it was also a small business that my family does. I've taught all my children woodworking. They're wood turners, if you guys have any wood turners in the house. All my children, we own like 4 wood lathes and a 12 by 24 shop just dedicated to woodworking, and my daughter, my youngest daughter Hannah, who's with me, she started wood turning at the age of 9. She was demonstrating wood turning at woodcraft stores in Austin and San Antonio as a young child on a treadle lathe, a foot-powered lathe. And so I've taught them how to use equipment, but there's some equipment like a bandsaw or the table saw, things that are more powerful and are more dangerous. And that means the more power something has, the more care you have to give it. Well, we're putting some very powerful tools in the hands of children and not giving them, not even thinking about how much care needs to go into what it takes to handle that tool. So we need some careful handling. We need purposeful use. Purposeful use. I've been saying for years, one of the worst things, you don't hear the term as often anymore. It's weird how terminology changes, but we used to talk about surfing the net, you know, early on. So if you're older, maybe the young kids never even heard of surfing the net, but surfing the net really was the idea that you just had no plan. You just turned on, opened up a browser, and you just started clicking away. That's called surfing. It's one of the worst things anybody could ever do with their time. If you want trouble, you're going to find it surfing because it's not purposeful. You don't even have the Bible says in Proverbs, ponder the path of your feet. Ponder your path. You don't just say, you know what, I think I'm just going to blindfold myself and walk out into a busy street, hoping I'll cross the road okay. All right, and the other thing which the Bible talks a lot about, not very popular in our culture today, that's self-control. You know, God has given us the ability by His Spirit through discernment, through the Word of God, to exercise self-control. It's a fruit of the Holy Spirit. We are called to have self-control, and our young people can also learn self-control. So we'll talk about that. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 24 and 25, I mentioned this yesterday. Do you not know that those who run in a race all run, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win. Everyone who competes in the games exercises self-control in all things. They then do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So as Christians, we are called to exercise self-control in all things. And if there's one area in life right now that we need more self-control in, it's how we handle media and technology. Now, I want to talk about how we got here. And by the way, as just on a personal level, my family and I were in this with you. You know, I don't actually stand here as like, you know, hey, I've got all the answers and shame on you and I'm going to point the finger. No, I'm with you. I'm just a spokesman for our generation saying we've got a lot of challenges, and as a family, we've been wrestling with all of these issues and working through them. And so, but I do want to talk about how we got here and what we can learn from knowing a little bit about the past. And most would agree that one of the most culturally impactful inventions in modern history, which may not seem too modern right now because it was almost 400 years ago, was the printing press. Or actually, it was over 400 years ago. So the printing press, but after the printing press, it was 400 years before the next game-changing technology. And so on May 24th, 1844, our nation was introduced to one of the biggest leaps in technology that would change the world as it had been known. That game-changing technology, believe it or not, was the telegraph. And you might think, what? How was that so game-changing? And in fact, you might not have known that the first message was sent from Baltimore on May 24th, 1844, and it was a Bible verse. What hath God wrought? I don't know if that should have been the right quote. But nevertheless, this was Samuel Morse sent this from his invention. And since then, the world has changed. And let me share with you how the world was, through this invention, on the brink of a paradigm shift that would impact the way we communicate. It impacted the way we would gather news, the way we would work, the way we would play. And it would affect homes, businesses, governments, and even churches. It would impact how we relate to one another. But how did the telegraph do all this? Well, you have to know that before the invention of the telegraph, there was no way to communicate simultaneously across distance, out of eyesight and earshot. You couldn't do it. There's no way you could have simultaneous communication. This was the greatest leap in communication, that you could now simultaneously communicate with people 100, 1,000, now thousands of miles away. But it began with the telegraph. Until then, as Marshall McLuhan put it, it was not until the advent of the telegraph that messages could travel faster than a messenger. The closest competitor before that was a fast horse. And an interesting example is provided in Maggie Jackson's book, Distracted. She says, news of George Washington's death in Virginia took a week to reach New York. While nearly 70% of the country knew that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated within a half hour of the Dallas shooting. So a big shift in how communication happens. And so it was the telegraph, believe it or not, and if you follow history and you know what invention led to the next, which led to the next, which led to the next, the telegraph was the granddaddy of telephones, and then that gave rise to radio. In fact, the first radio broadcast was broadcast over telegraphs, wireless telegraph, and it was a Christian man in the early 1900s on Christmas Eve who broadcast through the wireless telegraph systems with the first radio broadcast, and he read scripture, and he sang O Holy Night, and it was, I think, a really good start to radio. But basically, it came through telegraph machines. So when they were used to hearing beep, 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 all pretty soon it was like, hello, broadcasting to you from, you know. By the way, here's another interesting thing, broadcast. Radio was the first ones to adopt this word broadcast for scattering out the information. But you need to know that they borrowed the term. Broadcasting is an agricultural term. I grew up in an agricultural area in central Oregon. And there's two ways you can plant. You can either drill the seeds in, or you can use a broadcaster, so grass seed and other things. So this goes back. Jesus actually talked about broadcasting, didn't he? A sower went out to sow, and he scattered his seed. That's called broadcasting, and they used to do it by hand, have a little bag, a little satchel, and broadcast. So radio borrowed that from agriculture, and it's this idea that you're scattering seed, and you're hoping, you don't actually know if it's going to grow or not. And so that new technology of radio also was sending stuff out, but you didn't know who was actually hearing it or whether it was making an impact. I think that reminds us also and should remind us of the continual broadcasting that we need to do of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we can do it through some of these technologies as well. But it also radio gave rise to television, and then also it gave rise to the internet. So all of that came about from this one invention, the telegraph. Now, this new era of simultaneous living, who could deny the enormous advantage? But did people really see the challenges? It's funny, when I was interviewing Maggie Jackson for my documentary Captivated, and by the way, we brought some copies, but if you weren't here yesterday, I'm sorry to tell you, I only could fit so much stuff in a suitcase, and I was actually surprised how much, so a lot of the materials just are nearly sold out. There might be a couple copies left, but those are available on our website, mediatalk101.org. I used to be able to tell people you could watch Captivated on Amazon. It was recently pulled off of Amazon. I can't tell you why, but it is not there anymore. It's not available. You can still find it, but it'll tell you this title is no longer available, and I can't seem to be able to get it back on there. So, but you can find the DVD or digital versions of it on our website, mediatalk101.org. But when I was interviewing Maggie Jackson, and she was talking about the telegraph, and she said that there was a book, and we actually show this clip in the documentary. There was a book written in the 1800s. And it was a fiction book. It was a love story about two telegraph operators that fall in love online, you know. And once again, 1800s that this was written. And they were flirting with one another, and they finally want to meet each other. And when they meet each other, it's so awkward. They don't know how to relate to each other. And he wants to propose to the girl, so in the book, they have to rent two rooms of a boarding house, and they string a telegraph line between them so that he can communicate with her and propose marriage. So that should have given us a hint at what was coming. So I want to talk about some definitions, though, that are very important, because as I talk about technology, there's an important difference between technology and media, and I'll give you some just, you know, something that hopefully will clarify some things. But as I'm talking about technology, that's such a broad topic, and in the broader scope, the Pilot G2 gel pens that I write with all the time is a new technology. You know, I'm not writing with a quill and an inkhorn. So I actually appreciate the new technology of gel ink pens. And so when I'm talking about technology, we're narrowing it down from just those type of technologies to consumer, and even a little bit more than just a consumer electronics, because, you know, an electric razor is a new technology, and it's electronic. So what I'm talking about is I use the term technology, and is what and how our culture uses it most often is the use of common electronic devices for communication, some type of communication. You're getting information, you're sending information. So now as we talk about mediums, media and mediums are two different things. Devices are known as mediums. So a television is a medium. A radio is a medium. Your smartphone is a medium. A non-electric analogy would be a painter who uses a canvas and brushes and acrylic paints to produce a painting. But those paints and the canvas, that's all the medium of producing that. And the final painting is what we would call the media. So the sculptor uses the medium of wood stone or clay to create a three-dimensional image. An author is indebted to the work of a printer and a bookbinder to take the thoughts and replicate them using the medium of ink and paper to produce a book. So as we talk about media, media is that finished painting, that sculpture, that book that you read. So a television is a medium. The TV shows are the media. And FM radio is the medium. The actual device is the medium. But the songs, the news, the nonsense being broadcast, that's all the media. You know, so the laptop is a medium. But all the things that you can do on that and interacting, that's oftentimes the media. So, but I do want to, another thing I want you to understand is the word entertainment. Because entertainment at its root means to hold the attention. Hold the attention. So in that sense, in that pure sense of the word, I hope this is entertaining. I hope that I can hold your attention. Do you know Jesus held people's attention when he spoke? That's important. But you have to understand that's where the word comes from. It means to hold the attention. So entertainment holds the attention. The question is what is it that's entertaining people? What is it? Well, if it's a message like this today, I think that's a good use of entertaining your attention. So as we look at this, technology is not evil. It can be used for evil things, but technology is not evil. It is powerful. Now imagine that you're working in you're in your backyard, maybe you're barbecuing in your backyard, and you see your neighbor over the weekend. We'll call him Bill. So Bill is building a shed, and he's doing it old school, not with pneumatic tools. He's got a hammer and nails, and he's framing it up, and it's looking beautiful. And you say, you look over the fence, you say, "Hi, Bill, looking good, doing a great job. You know, what a great craftsman you are." "Oh, thanks a lot." But then the next day, you're in the local grocery store, and you see Bill again. But Bill still has his hammer in hand. And he's constantly staring at it, fixated on it. And you even try to say hi to Bill, but he can almost not even look up from his hammer. And you're going, like, that's just a little weird, you know. And then you encounter Bill, you know, walking down the sidewalk, you know, a couple days later, and he still has his hammer. And everywhere you see Bill, he's got his hammer, and he's constantly fixated on it. And he's just, and you're going, like, if that was a true story, what would you think about Bill? You go, this guy's got some real problems. He needs to go see a counselor. I hear there's counseling at Cornerstone Bible Church. You know, you can send Bill to Cornerstone Bible Church. He needs some counseling. He's got a problem with his hammer. You know, but once again, you've probably picked up on it already. We're not talking about hammers, are we? We're talking about these kind of tools. You know, a hammer is a tool. And when it's used in the right way, it can be very useful for putting nails into boards. But when you begin to become imbalanced in your use of technology and no longer use it in its proper place, it's one thing to look at Bill and say, you've got a problem. But now, you know, are we going to recognize the problem that we have? If you remember, for those of you who are the digital immigrants like myself, you used to live and work and move and have your being with just a telephone attached to the wall and sometimes even a party line. And then, you know, as new technologies came and it was only for the wealthy and the prestigious who could own the suitcase that had a phone, you know, it was like the portable phone in a suitcase, that's what they used to look like. That was not you, so you were resigned to the pager. How many used to have a pager? I ran a business in Chicago using a pager. And kids are going like, what? Yeah, it's a little square box that will give you, someone calls it from a payphone or their home phone, and their number comes up on a little screen. And then you would call, you would find a payphone, which I would do in Chicago, and you'd call them back. But I remember when cell phones started first getting into the hands of the average person, and it trickled in. And I remember the frustration that everybody would have if you were at a restaurant and the one person in the restaurant who had a cell phone is flaunting it. You know, it's ringing. They pick it up. They're talking loud. It's like, ooh, I got a cell phone. You know, nobody else has a cell phone. And everybody like wanted to pummel it. I want to like take that cell phone and pitch it across the room, you know. you're just so frustrated. And that's really the way it was. You may recall until you had a cell phone. And then you were the one like, ooh, I got a cell phone. And then everybody's got a cell phone, and now nobody's complaining about how disrupting they are in culture. Smartphones are powerful tools, but they're not phones. They're palm-sized computers. Think about everything you have access in the palm of your hand. It's a phone, but it's a TV, it's a computer, it's the internet, it's a video player, it's a game device, it's a word processor, it's a weather station. It's 8.9 million mobile apps right now worldwide. There are so many things you could do with a phone. They're more powerful than the computers that I grew up with. I actually didn't grow up with them. They kind of emerged while I was growing up. But what you have in your hand is much more powerful. And as I talked about the need for compassion for this generation, I imagine that if I was a teen and I was growing up with a device that gave me access to the world's largest arcade, gave me access to the world's largest collection of movies, gave me access to the world's largest collection of porn, gave me access to my friends 24/7, how would I not have really struggled with all of those things? I did not have access like that in the palm of my hand. So we are really, and if you would imagine what this would have looked like 25 years ago, if you just go back in history, what would it look like if you would have all this stuff with you at all times? You know what? It would be kind of comical because you'd have to get a wheelbarrow or a cart to hold your television, which were much bigger and heavier, and you'd have to have a generator you'd pack along with you to power everything, and your radio and everything. And if you were trucking around 25 years ago with a cart full of all of this stuff, people would have thought you are an idiot. What a loser. Get a life. Why do you have to have this stuff with you all the time? So this is speaking for you kids, by the way. You're looking at a digital immigrant. That means I knew what life was like before all of these things. You're not. You're digital natives. You've never known what that was like. So it's hard for you to maybe understand. And parents, you need to realize that that's a real realistic gap. Your kids do not know what you know. I don't know what it's going to take for you to help them understand what life was like before, and that there may be some things that you're missing out on, but we need to try. And our problem's not confined to smartphones. Still, television is still, the statistics for TV is out of control these days still. But it doesn't mean we have to live without these things. It's a matter of whether these things are in our control, or are we under its spell? So we've been losing focus. I talked about yesterday the dripping faucet. I won't bring that up again other than to mention it, that the dripping faucet, as I talked about, is one of those ways we're losing attention. But also there are different types of attention that we have to understand. So I'm going to play a clip here from our documentary, Captivated. This is Dr. David Walsh speaking about a couple different types of attention systems, and I think what he has to say really intrigued me, and I hope it helps you as well.
There are different attention systems within the brain. We have one attention system deep within the brain in the limbic brain. I call it the reactive attention system. It is involuntary, hardwired. We don't have to learn it. It is hard. We are hardwired to pay attention to things that move and things that are emotionally stimulating. So that's the one that's working when I'm deeply engrossed in a great mystery. Okay, I'm reading a great mystery, and out of the very corner of my eye, I see a little mouse running on the floor. Where would my attention be focused? On that mouse. Okay? It's called the orientation response. We're wired to pay attention to things that move or things that are emotionally stimulating. There's another type of attention. That's the one that we use when we are paying attention to something that isn't moving, something that is emotionally stimulating. For many kids today who have a very, very heavy media diet, what they have is an overdeveloped reactive attention system and an underdeveloped focused attention system. And so we have a growing epidemic of distraction because kids are always responding to all of this technology that is constantly vying for their attention. And a lot of the ways that we used to develop focused attention system disappears.
Okay, Gary Small, MD, wrote a book called iBrain. Let me just read he talks about continuous partial attention. He says, our brains were not built to maintain such monitoring for extended time periods. Eventually, the endless hours of unrelenting digital connectivity can create a new, unique type of brain strain. Many people who have been working on the internet for several hours without a break report having frequent errors in their work. Upon signing off, they notice feeling spaced out, fatigued, irritable, and distracted as if they are in a digital fog. This new form of mental stress, what I term techno-brain burnout, is threatening to become an epidemic. So this techno-brain burnout, it's just there's something going on that's it's causing us to lose greater focus. So let's talk about how do we regain focus. How do we regain focus? Well, I want to talk about problems, some of the problems and the solutions. Regaining a focus, taking back the ground that we have lost. And in Colossians 3:17, it says, and whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks to God the Father through him. So as Christians, I believe that we need to regain this focus and we do it unto Jesus. We say, you know what? Help me, Lord. Help me, Holy Spirit. We've got a problem, but we want to resolve these problems in our life. We want to get on better footing. So the first thing we're going to look at for solutions, it's interesting, the secular world, is they're trying to work this out from a secular worldview. We're looking at this from a biblical worldview, but something they refer to, some of these solutions, as therapeutic lifestyle changes. Therapeutic lifestyle changes. And so I don't know what we would refer to it as, but yesterday I talked about goals and values. Goals and values. And you have to understand what the goal is. And I used Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. We're called to run a race. And because we value those things which are eternal. This is not about a return to the 1800s. Believe me, if we could get into a time machine and go back, I would be the first to sign up for that. I'd love to live in a time without all of these things. But God has, we are here for this time and place. And God says that he ordains that. You are ordained where you live and what time you live in. And so it's for such a time as this that we are the generation that needs to begin to develop some ancestral wisdom, which we do not have presently. We need to provide, that we need to be the ones that provide the next generation with some ancestral wisdom when it comes to why we do what we do. So we're looking for, not looking to go back. We can't go back. It's God help us to navigate these things wisely into the future. And we need to learn how to handle technology better than we presently are. And we need wisdom. So if you missed yesterday's, I heard that it was recorded and will probably be available on your various channels. So go back and learn more about goals and values. But I want to move on to the next one, and that is to prioritize presence. This is an easy one to understand. It's a difficult one to actually act upon. You need to prioritize presence. That means when you are face-to-face, whether it's with your children, at church, wherever you are, be all there. And, you know, there's something, it's one thing, I remember years ago, before smartphones were common among youth, remember a young college-age guy that I was having a chance to interact with, he was a new believer, and I could never have a conversation with him because as soon as we started conversing, he would be on his phone, and those were before the days of smartphones, so he's using T9, and he was so fast at texting with that. In fact, I was looking at him, and I finally said, you know what, I can't even talk to you. This is really distracting. Maybe that doesn't distract you, but it totally distracts me. I'm a digital immigrant. You know, I'm not used to this, you know. And he's, oh, check this out, Philip. And he puts his phone behind his back, and he comes back and shows me the message that he just typed out using T9. So I'm like, that's impressive, but just don't do it when we're talking. You know, I'd like to converse with you. But it's not just kids, you know. It's there's something now known as the distracted parent syndrome. And when you are on your device, there's a lot of things that happen that you may not realize that's happening. First of all, you lose your hearing. Did you know that? I mean, not literally lose your hearing, but there, you begin to tune out what things are happening around you. You become unaware of time. the time that you are on your device. And you that distraction has really frustrated children as they have tried to get the attention of their parents and can't get the attention of their parents. I talked about yesterday just some phone-free zones. So at least have one meal together each day with no phones, you know. So they've been saying this for years. If you've watched even secular PSAs, they'll say that the greatest anti-drug in your family is a mealtime together. And so it's interesting that there's so much that the Bible talks about gathering around food, and that needs to begin in the home. So you need to at least carve out at least one meal a day where you're all determined, mom, dad, kids. How many have seen the documentary Social Dilemma? It's a Netflix. I'm not a fan of Netflix. I actually signed up for 1 month just to watch this documentary because someone told me about it. I don't know if you can see it anywhere else. So it's a brand new documentary on social media and how it's manipulating kids. So you young people, it would be an important documentary. Maybe talk to your parents, see if you can do a watch party together and all watch The Social Dilemma. And you can learn from the industry insiders who develop these things like Twitter and other things about how this is all designed to manipulate you, and you become the product. You are the product to these companies. And they are selling you and your information. But what's interesting is they had little vignettes all throughout that documentary of a family that's struggling, and they had the one older sister who was deeply concerned about this and always like razzing her family about it, and so her mom kind of gets a little convicted and buys this device that's a locker for their smartphones. It actually had a timer that would keep it locked during that time. So She sits them all down for a dinner, and it's very awkward because they're not used to this. And she takes all their phones and puts it in this little lockbox and sets the timer for dinner time. And they're all sitting around, and maybe this would look like what it would be in your house if you're not used to doing this. Everybody's like, this is awkward. What are we supposed to do? And there was one of the teenage girls who's just flipping out about not having her phone. And there's the funniest scene because she just can't handle it anymore. She just bolts up out of her chair, runs over to that thing, grabs something in the kitchen, I don't remember what it was, and smashes the thing in pieces, takes her phone and walks upstairs, you know. And it's a comical scene, but it's a very sad scene because that's the level of addiction that is happening. So we need to prioritize present. Do that with a meal. Cultivate real social face-to-face relationships. Young people, as I talked about, values what you value, that there are things that are more valuable than other things. So gold is more valuable than tinfoil. And three or four deep relationships are more valuable than 300, 400 superficial social media connections. Because none of those connections, those when you're down and out, when you're having a tough day, when you need someone to talk to heart, face to face, they're not going to be there for you. And they're not there for you. So I want to encourage you to say, you know what? It's more valuable. I want to value having even two or three really strong relationships. But in order to have those strong relationships, you have to cultivate them. And that's not what's not happening because your time is spent cultivating superficial connections. So you need to decide what's important to you. Another thing that's interesting is Robin Dunbar. He's an evolutionary anthropologist from England. I don't agree with him on his evolutionary ideas. He's done studies in sociology and just this idea of these superficial connections. It's interesting to me. There's something called Dunbar's number. In his studies, he's found that people really can't have more than 150 connections with people, even on a superficial level. So the most superficial level, the extent of those connections are only 150. But it breaks down. The next group is that you'll be a little more close to would be a group of about 50. And then from there, it's a group of about 15, and then there's about five really close relationships in your life. So, and that became very popular. His studies became popular in regard to social media because it's impossible for you to really have 1,000 friends. You can't do it. You can't maintain 1,000 friends. And they can't maintain 1,000 connections. So it's all superficial. So we need to decide, you know, it's more important to cultivate a handful of friends. Prioritize presence. Okay, 11, self-control and discipline. I've talked about self-control. We need greater self-control as families and as individuals, and we need God's help. But discipline, as we talk about being disciples, disciples take discipline. And that, just like if you have a goal to run a marathon and you're in training for that, you're going to have to get out there and run every day. You're going to have to practice. And in this situation, we need to put these things to practice, and it's going to be hard work. I'm not going to soft sell this to you. This is not easy. But if you have the right goal, and you know that God's calling you to this, then you discipline yourself. You have self-control. Also, number 12, you need to overcome the myth of multitasking. Overcome the myth of multitasking. All the studies have proven it's not possible to multitask. And we're not talking about walking and chewing gum at the same time. Those do not take thought. You know, you can just walk and you can chew gum. But when we're talking about complex things, like driving a car and using a phone at the same time, like texting, those, you cannot do those things at the same time. It's what they call, what they've realized, it's called rapid task switching. So just change your terminology. Don't say, oh, I'm a great multitasker. No, you're not. You might be good, you might be a really fast, rapid task switcher, but you have to realize there's a switching cost, which means when you're driving a car, you're focused on the road. If you begin to focus on your phone, you are no longer driving. And that's why we have accidents. So you can't be doing both. You're just switching back between them quickly. So you're driving blind for a while. You're looking at your phone. You're going back to driving. You're looking at your phone. When you're trying to work and you're trying to do something productive and you have your phone set and you've got all these notifications happening and they're distracting you, then they're taking your thoughts. In fact, this is so, just so you know this, years ago there was a book that I read that really spelled this out very well. And they've done studies that even when you're reading on the computer and you're reading an article that has hyperlinks in it, even that, it takes a train of thought. You know, think about the trains on the track, you're following the article, you're trying to actually gain some wisdom and knowledge from what you're reading, and then in the middle of the article there's a hyperlink. Now, whether you know it or not, your mind has to stop for a moment, a fraction of a second, to go, do I click that hyperlink or do I not click that hyperlink? I don't think I'm going to click that hyperlink. So you don't choose to click the hyperlink, but what has just happened? The train had to stop suddenly in the middle of that sentence in order to decide whether it was going to click the hyperlink or not. Decides not to click the hyperlink, and then you continue on. Now the train has to actually get rolling again, and you might have even forgot now what you were just reading. That's why, by the way, on a practical level, for years knowing this, I print out everything onto paper because your brain interacts with paper differently than a screen. And that's one of the reasons, because of hyperlinks. And you might think, man, that's costly. Yeah, it is. And that's why I've learned how to refill my own ink cartridges. I'm so devoted to this. All right.
Kids are absolutely convinced that they can multitask. Young kids tell me, you may not be able to multitask, Dr. Walsh, but you're an old guy. But we can do it because we've been raised with it.
One piece of research out of Stanford recently showed that if you're learning something and you're multitasking, actually you're not going to remember what you learned very well. You're using parts of your brain related to more automatic activity. If you're multitasking while studying, you're doing your homework, and you're not using the parts of your brain related to deep memory.
And so the research has been done, and it's very clear, even though young people think they can multitask, they can't, because our brains are not built for it. Our brains are only built to focus attention on one thing at a time. Now, if things don't take focused attention, you can do multiple things. So I can chew gum and walk and carry on conversations, because chewing gum and walking don't take a lot of attention. But if I'm trying to focus attention, I can't divide that effectively. When we try to multitask, we lose speed, efficiency, and accuracy. And the research is very clear.
All right, the next thing, when regaining focus, we need to get better sleep. Talked a little bit about this. You need to minimize blue light at night. Have your bed have your phones, your devices have a bedtime earlier than yours. They recommend at least an hour or two before you go to bed, you should really not have any light, because God designed a world that has a sun that comes up and the sun that goes down, and he knew that we would have lamps, incandescent lights eventually, but even fire is a warm, it's not a blue light. It's a warm light, and if you, whether it's candlelight or by fire, you know that that makes you sleepy. It's actually hard to stay alert and awake with low lighting, but that's what culture lived with. And now what happens with blue light, which is daylight, and it's good during the day, but it's terrible when the sun goes down because you're not wired. God didn't wire you to be having blue light hitting you through the night, but that's what we're doing. It's because of that that you can completely trick the system that God has ordered in your life. And that's why kids could stay up all night long playing video games, light emitting plus the just this overwhelming stimulation that's happening, get a couple hours of sleep, get up and go to school the next day and do this again. Now, they can do it, but it's not healthy and it's hurting them. And it's hurting you. So just put your devices, it's a simple thing, just set a bedtime for your devices and make sure it's at least an hour earlier than your bedtime. And then use the evening, you know, to have incandescent lights. Thankfully, they're making warm LED lights now. And you can turn those lights down, you get a book, you know, read, and let your mind have some rest from all that. Let God, the process that God has given you to wind down and to get sleepy. There's a lot more to this. You could do some reading up if you just studied, did some search and do some study on blue light, cortisol, sleep, circadian rhythms, all of that. You can learn some of this. You should also keep phones out of bedrooms. In fact, we have one computer that's central in the house and it's facing publicly, and so we keep devices out of bedrooms, and especially at night, we actually turn off the Wi-Fi. Literally, I have a cut-off switch in our home, and it just cuts off the internet at a certain time. And then, so these are some things. You need to get better sleep. Kids are getting terrible sleep. It's affecting them. Adults are not getting good sleep these days. God wants you, your mind, to get some rest. There's things that you will be more, your mind will be more prepared for action for the kingdom if it's rested. It's the way God designed it. So we need to not undermine sleep. It's important. I gave this quote yesterday, Jim Elliot, wherever you are, be all there, live to the hilt every situation you believe to be the will of God. All right, the next thing is to redeem the time. The Bible says redeem the time because the days are evil. If ever there was a time to redeem the time, it's in our days. And so we need to redeem, that means to purchase back. We've lost it. You need to buy it back. And buying it back is going to take discipline. All right, number 15, purposeful use of tech and the internet. I'm keeping track of the time here. I'm going to try to get through in the last minute these last slides. I know yesterday I found that many of you are OCD and it just drives you crazy if you don't get all the lines filled in. Okay, purposeful use of tech and internet. Number 16, better, smarter parenting of young children. All right, let me just close with this. We won't get all of the things, but I'll just close with this illustration. It's so important. In animal management today, primarily in the U.S., what we do is we build strong fences. I used to raise sheep. I built strong fences to keep my sheep in. I saw them once a day, made sure they had food and water. God has not called us to just build fences in our children's lives. That's not the solution. God's called you to be a shepherd. And shepherds around the world, I've been in Africa, I've seen the Maasai tribe, they're the shepherding tribe. They're out there, there are no fences, but what they have, which we don't, is presence. Parents are present in their children's lives. And we need that. So we need some better parenting. We need some smarter parenting. All right, I've run out of time, always do, but thank you again for having me. I'm looking forward to speaking with you again during the regular service hour.